You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. This week, we'll hear all about that report in The Intercept with a new whistleblower who has information about the U.S. military's use of radio-controlled drones. Plus, we'll hear about the new report about numbers of new television and radio stations in the United States and what percentage of Americans don't use the internet at all. We'll hear how National Public Radio's audience is growing older, and we'll hear how tech companies have come out against the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act that just passed the U.S. Senate. We'll also hear about the U.S. government's new plan to register radio-controlled drones in the United States. One update. First, on October 22nd, the Federal Communications Commission passed a measure to lower the cost of prison phone calls and calls to prisons so that families will have cheaper rates than before, where phone calls were up to $14 a minute. Costs will now be more affordable for prisoners and their families to communicate. There are 15% more radio and television stations in the United States now than there were 10 years ago, Radio World reports. There are now 31,013 licensed broadcast stations in the country as of September 30th, 2015. The biggest jumps in number of stations came from low-power FM, up 128%, and FM educational stations, up 56%. Low-power FM was legalized just before 2005 and expanded in the past decade, and the FCC had a rare FM educational application window in 2008, which explained the large increases there. The economics of running a television station explain the 39% drop in VHF commercial television stations. Their bandwidth has become more valuable for commercial wireless applications than for mass broadcasting, which can be done cheaper now at other frequencies. Also fewer in numbers, Class A VHF TV stations down 82%, VHF translators down 53%, and VHF low-power TV stations down 27%. Current magazine reports that the average quarter-hour listening during National Public Radio's morning drive time has dropped 11% in the past 5 years, and the afternoon audience is down 6%. Young people are listening even less, and the only age bracket with a listening increase is 65+. The Morning Edition show has 20% fewer listeners under 55 since 2010, Nielsen data shared by NPR says, and All Things Considered had a slight gain among listeners aged 12 to 24 and 55 to 64, but larger growth among 65-plus listeners. NPR is now guessing that in 2020, 30% of its audience will be 44 years old or younger, a figure that was almost double in 1985. NPR's podcast downloads rose 75% last year, and NPR.org grew nearly 35%, so there is some hope for the future. About 15% of U.S. adults do not use the internet, a new Pew Research Center analysis of survey data reports. In the year 2000, almost half of Americans did not use the internet, but that rate of conversion has slowed the past 3 years, the survey reports. A 2013 Pew survey found three reasons people do not use the internet: no interest, too difficult to use, and too expensive. Younger Americans and those that live in urban areas are more likely to use the internet, the survey found. The Washington Post reports many major tech companies oppose the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, a so-called cybersecurity bill expected to see a vote in the U.S. Senate next week. Yelp, Reddit, Twitter, Apple, Dropbox, and the Wikimedia Foundation all have come out against the bill. Quote, "The trust of our customers means everything to us, and we don't believe security should come at the expense of their privacy," unquote, Apple's statement on the issue said. Google, Facebook, and Yahoo are lobbying through the Computer and Communications Industry Association against the bill, too. Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said October 20th that the bill allows companies to share information on, quote, cyber threats, unquote, unquote, with the government, but does not allow the government to share personal data. Quote, things like social security numbers, addresses, passwords, and credit information would be unrelated to a cyber threat and would, except in very exceptional circumstances, be removed, unquote, Feinstein said. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden is against the bill and said, quote, if you share more information without strong privacy protections, millions of Americans will say that is not a cybersecurity bill, it is a surveillance bill, unquote. The Senate did vote for the CISA cyber surveillance bill on October 22nd. The Senate voted 83-14 in favor of the cyber surveillance bill. The Associated Press reported October 19th that the U.S. government will require registration of some publicly available radio-controlled drone aircraft. After a number of close calls and problems with drones in airports, forest fires, and sensitive government sites, government action was expected on radio-controlled drones. Airport sightings of drones went from a handful last year to hundreds in 2015, according to the Federal Aviation Authority. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said, quote, finding the drone has not been as much of a problem as finding the person who was using the drone, unquote. The FAA and the Transportation Department will create a 25 to 30 member task force to set the parameters of the tracking system, with toys and small drones likely exempt. Consumer Electronics Association has forecast that 700,000 drones will be sold this holiday season, the Associated Press reported. There is a new Edward Snowden, and this whistleblower is opening up about radio-controlled drones and the U.S. military's assassination program in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Jeremy Scahill writes in The Intercept that, quote, the first drone strike outside of a declared war zone was conducted more than 12 years ago. Yet it was not until May 2013 that the White House released a set of standards and procedures for conducting such strikes, unquote. Some of the revelations in The Intercept reporting includes that as many as 90% of U.S. drone killings in one five-month period weren't the intended targets, that a former British citizen was killed in a radio-controlled drone strike despite repeated opportunities to capture him instead, and details of the grisly process by which the American government chooses who will live and who will die. The whistleblower is so far anonymous, but gave The Intercept a statement for release. Quote, this outrageous explosion of watch listing, of monitoring people and racking and stacking them on lists, assigning them numbers, assigning them baseball cards, assigning them death sentences without notice, on a worldwide battlefield, it was, from the very first instance, wrong. We're allowing this to happen, and by we, I mean every American citizen who has access to this information now, but continues to do nothing about it, unquote. The stories in The Intercept and the congressional testimony from those in drone zones such as Pakistan are chilling. Let's listen to a collage of sounds and stories from the drone wars on This Week in Radio News.
And Ranking Member Cruz for inviting me here today. My name, as you mentioned, is Farah Al-Muslimi, and I am from Musab, a remote village mountain in Yemen. Just 6 days ago, my village was struck by an American drone in an attack that terrified the region's poor farmers. Musab is my village, but America has helped me grow up and become what I am today. I come from a family that lives off the fruit, vegetables, and livestock we raise in our farms. My father's income rarely exceeded $200. He learned to read late in his life, and my mother never did. My life, however, has been different. I am who I am today because the U.S. State Department supported my education. I spent a year living with an American family and attended an American high school. That was one of the best years of my life. I learned about American culture, managed the school basketball team, and participated in a trick or treat in Halloween. But the most exceptional experience was coming to know someone who ended up being like a father to me. who is a member of the U.S. Air Force. Most of my year was spent with him and his family. He came to the mosque with me, and I went to church with him, and he became my best friend in America. I went to the U.S. as an ambassador for Yemen, and I came back to Yemen as an ambassador of the U.S. I could never have imagined that the same hand that changed my life and took it from miserable to promising one would also draw my village. My understanding is that a man named Hamid al-Radami was the target of a drone strike. Many people in Wisab know al-Radami, and the Yemeni government could easily have found and arrested him. Al-Radami was well known to government officials and even to local government, and even local government could have captured him if the U.S. had told them to do so. In the past, what Wisab villagers knew of the U.S. was based on my stories about my wonderful experiences here. The friendships and values I experienced and described to the villagers helped them understand the America that I know and that I love. Now, however, when they think of America, they think of the terror they feel from the drones that hover over their heads, ready to fire missiles at any time. What a violent militants had previously failed to achieve, one drone strike accomplished in an instant. There is now an intense anger against America in Wasab. This is not an isolated instance. The drone strikes are the face of America to many Yemenis. I have spoken to many victims of U.S. drone strikes, like a mother in Ja'ar who had to identify her innocent 18-year-old son's body through a video on a stranger's cell phone. Or the father in Shakra who held his 4 and 6-year-old children as they died in his arms. Recently in Aden, I spoke with one of the tribal leaders present in 2009 at the place where the U.S. cruise missiles targeted the village of Al-Ma'jala in Lodar, Abyan. More than 40 civilians were killed, including 4 pregnant women. The tribal leader and others tried to rescue the victims, but the bodies were so decimated that it was impossible to differentiate between those of the children, women, and their animals. Some of these innocent people were buried in the same grave as their animals.
Overseas, this week, we reportedly launched deadly drone strikes in both Waziristan and Yemen. You probably didn't hear about them on the news unless you were watching this.
The U.S. has carried out another drone attack in Pakistan's restive tribal areas, killing at least 8 people.
That's the only footage reporting either strike that we could find, and it's from the Iranian government's English language TV station. That channel is buried deep in your cable package. I think it's actually somewhere between C-SPAN Junior and CAN, the Kirsty Alley Network. But there is something strange about the fact that we launched deadly drone strikes in 2 sovereign nations that almost no one here heard about. But then again, why would it make the news? We use drones all the time. Hard numbers are very difficult to come by for reasons that we'll get into. But by one estimate, during the Obama administration, we've launched 8 times the number of drone strikes than we did under his predecessor. And while they've declined a bit recently, drone strikes will be as much a characteristic of the Obama presidency as Obamacare or receiving racist email forwards from distant relatives. And it's easy to see why drones are so popular. They cost less than manned planes and they kill a lot of terrorists. Their slogan should really be appealingly cheap and incredibly deadly, but unfortunately, that's already been taken by Hardee's. And they're not just popular with the White House. Surveys consistently show a majority of Americans approve of our use of drone strikes to fight extremists abroad. In fact, we're so comfortable with them, nobody blinked an eye when the president said this.
The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming.
You'll lie there, your aorta's riddled with shrapnel fired from the sky, gurgling your last blood-soaked breath. It's funny because it's possible. I could do that. That's something I could do.
Drones over Brooklyn, drones over Brooklyn, drones over Brooklyn, drones over Brooklyn. bring it back.
Drone strikes are one of those things that it's really convenient not to think about that much. But if you happen to live underneath drones, not thinking about them is not an option. Having drones hovering above you is bound to mess with your head, especially because you might not even be able to see them.
Even though I know there's a predator directly overhead, I still can't hear a thing. And if you look up to the exact spot where we're being told the predator is flying right now, there's nothing but clouds and blue sky.
Congratulations, everyone. We did it. We managed to make one of the last remaining universal symbols of pleasantness, blue sky, completely terrifying. We did it. Woo! How do we decide when to use a drone strike? Now, on the surface, the Obama administration's answer seems straightforward.
We only take these kinds of actions when there's an imminent threat, when capture is not feasible, and when we are confident that we're doing so in a way that's consistent with federal and international law.
Okay, that sounds reassuring until you look closer at it. As Eric Holder just said, drone strikes are justified if you can show an imminent threat. Now, that sounds clear. There's not much of a linguistic loophole there unless you make one.
NBC News has obtained this confidential 16-page Justice Department memo. It says an imminent threat does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future.
Well, but an imminent threat does have to take place in the immediate future, because that's what the word imminent means. When someone says, I'm going to have a baby imminently, it doesn't mean I may or may not have a baby at some point in the future. It means, get your car keys, my water just broke. And it turns out imminent isn't the only word with a surprisingly fluid definition when it comes to drone strikes. What defines a civilian when it comes to civilian casualties has also allegedly been open to interpretation.
There's also been some dispute over the way civilian casualties are counted. The CIA often counts able-bodied males, military-age males, who are killed in strikes as militants unless they have concrete evidence to sort of prove them innocent.
Hold on. If it's assumed you're with the terrorists, if you're in the same vicinity and around the same age as them, it's not how little we know about who the government is killing, but how little they themselves seem to know.
NBC News has examined classified documents detailing 114 drone strikes. They also reveal what U.S. officials don't know, like how many killed. Between 7 and 10 in one strike, 20 to 22 in another. It suggests U.S. officials don't always know exactly how many or who they're killing.
That is a little disturbing. Because the question, how many people have you killed in drone strikes, is not one of those questions where it's okay to say, I don't know. It's not like asking someone, who was the voice of Disney's Aladdin, or what are Skittles made from? It's different. It's different than that. And the crazy thing is, it has literally always been like this. The very first CIA drone strike back in 2002 killed three men, reportedly because they thought one of them might have been Bin Laden, in part, and this is true, due to his height. And under that rationale, it's kind of remarkable that we didn't take out Jeff Goldblum at some point over the years. Now, reports later indicated the victim was actually an innocent man who was collecting scrap metal. And look how the Pentagon immediately set the template for every discussion we've had about drone strikes since.
You said you don't know who was killed in this attack, whether it's civilians, Taliban,
no,
or...
I'm sorry.
We don't know exactly who it was.
We don't know the identities of the individuals involved.
But you're convinced they're Taliban?
We're convinced that...
We're convinced it was an appropriate target. Based on the observation, based on the information, that it was an appropriate target. We do not know yet exactly who it was.
It's never a good idea to make a major decision about someone when you can't even say exactly who they are. Hey, guys, I got married last night. Oh, really? Who is he? I don't know exactly at this time, but I'm convinced he's an appropriate husband based on his height.
I operated the camera. So, like, the camera, zoom in, zoom out, make sure that everyone can see a good picture, make sure it's in focus. guide the laser, shoot the spot tracker.
How clear are the resolution? How clear are these images?
It's pretty clear, depending on like atmospherics and how what your elevation is at, it can be pretty clear. We're just sitting there, and we're like, okay, these guys are obviously bad guys, you know? The guy in the back hears the sonic boom when it reaches him, and he runs forward. We were actually told to get the two guys in front, worry about the guy in the back later, follow him to wherever he goes. Guy in the back runs forward between the two, and we strike all three of them. And the guy that was running forward, when the smoke clears, there's a crater there, he's missing his right leg, and I watch this guy bleed out. And it's clear enough that I watch him, he's grabbing his leg and he's rowing. I can almost see the agony on this guy's face. And eventually, this guy becomes the same color as the ground that he bled. And
so he loses his teeth. You watch him die.
Yeah. It was, you know how people say that drone strikes are like mortar attacks, artillery. Well, artillery doesn't see this. Artillery doesn't see the results of their actions. It's really more intimate for us because we see everything. We see the before action, or before action and then after. And so I watched this guy, I watched him bleed out. I watched the result of, I guess collectively it was our action, but ultimately I'm the responsible one who guided him this week.
So when did you start feeling bad about this program? And why? Why did it start to eat away at your...
Because I lost that respect for life.
You'd become an assassin.
I'd become heartless. I'd become... It
You felt like you were a hitman.
Not necessarily. I just felt like a sociopath, if you want to say that. I wanted to kill these people. These were bad guys. We had a list of their accomplishments underneath them, but instead of being like, man, these guys need to die, but I'm really sad that we have to execute extreme measures, I was like, man, I can't wait for these guys to die. When I left the 3rd SOS, they gave me a sheet of paper that said had all my accomplishments, and they handed me this paper. So of all the missions combined, either directly fired shots, buddy lasers, help bombs dropped from aircraft that I guided in, insurgents, raids, people that were captured, there were 1,626 total people killed on every mission that I went on.
How did you feel when you saw that piece of paper and written there, 1,626 dead people?
Disgusted with myself, actually.
Does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on the American soil? The answer is no. The answer to that question is no.
What's up, cameraman? Come on, guys. They're breaking my flow all the time.
That was congressional testimony. Also, some excerpts from John Oliver's HBO show and his special on radio-controlled drones last year. I'm Tom Rowe, reporting for Waveform Radio and WGXC on This Week in Radio News.
Preceding show was recorded at Waveform's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.